Today's guests, Dan Silverman, MD, and Idell Davidson, authors of the eye-opening book, Your Brain After Chemo, A Groundbreaking Guide to Post-Chemo Brain, argue that there is plenty of evidence to the contrary. Thankfully, you can rest assured that you're not alone in feeling this way and that you can do something about it. Dan Silverman, MD, PhD, is head of the Neuronuclear Imaging Section in the Ahmanson Biological Imaging Division and Associate Professor of Molecular and Medical Pharmacology at UCLA. He is also the principal investigator of a national trial looking at the utility of brain imaging for patients experiencing mild decline in their cognitive abilities. Idell Davidson is an award-winning health, medical, and general interest journalist whose work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times Magazine, Time, Parents, Parenting, Los Angeles Discoveries, Catalyst, In Touch, First for Women, American Way, UCLA Magazine, New Jersey Monthly, and many other publications. Two of her documentary scripts were produced for Discovery Health Channel, and she is a former director of publications for the American Heart Association. Dr. Silverman, Idell, welcome to It's Your Health.
Good morning,
Lisa.
So glad to have you both here. Now, before we talk about your individual experiences with chemo brain, Idell, for you having gone through chemotherapy, and Dr. Silverman, for you having worked with patients and also researching it, can you tell us what is it, Dr. Silverman, and what are some of the hallmarks of it?
What people often refer to as chemo brain is really a syndrome, a cluster of different kinds of symptoms that can be different from person to person. So the things that they most commonly complain of or that maybe most have in common across people would be problems with being able to concentrate, problems with being able to maintain a focus on one thing for a period of time or to multitask on several things the way that they used to be able to, and problems with short-term memory.
Okay. You know, I talked to my father last night because my mother had ovarian cancer, and unfortunately she passed away. But I said, did she have any effects? And he said, you know, it was hard to tell because she had post-it notes everywhere, like all the time, reminding her of things. So he said, I really, you know, she never talked about it. Now, Idell, you did. And in the beginning of the book, right after the foreword, the reader begins to learn about you and your journey. And you write, I'm a little like Groucho Marx. He didn't wish to belong to any club that would accept someone like him as a member. But one club won't take no for my answer. So here is what I tell it. Do not call. Do not even whisper my name. Get me the hell out. Now, that also reminds me of my mom's reaction. Now, how and when did you learn that you had breast cancer?
Well, it was July 2005, and it was actually discovered by my gynecologist in a routine annual exam. And it was quite a shock, obviously, and I was in denial for quite some time. And ironically, I happened at the time to be a contributing editor to a cancer magazine. So what was ironic for me was that I had always been the reporter looking into stories. I never thought that I'd be the subject looking out. And I had a hard time asking people for help, accepting help. And I really just didn't even want to think about having cancer.
Yeah, you have a really poignant story in the book about that, about when you finally did sort of, I'd say, hit bottom and finally said, you know what, I need help. That was really, I was brought to tears, I just want to say.
Oh,
it was a beautiful story, and I'm glad that you got the help that you needed from your friends and family, because they love you, you know.
Well, that's the thing, too, is, you know, a lot of times we maintain this stiff upper lip, and we don't want to ask, we don't want to inconvenience people, we don't want to seem weak or needy in any way. But really what's happening is people who do love you, they want to be asked. Mm-hmm. They want to contribute. They want to sit with you at chemotherapy. They want to bring you food. In a way, it's a kindness to everybody to allow them into your life and to allow them to show you that they love you.
Yeah, that, I think
and
that's
it took me a long time to actually realize that.
Yeah, I've known someone recently who passed away, and it was just so, she kept everything so to herself, and we just, you know, you want to do more, and my mother was the opposite. My brother went out and moved in with her for 9 months, took care of around the clock, and one time he tried to help me, she's like, he's here helping me. I'm like, geez, you know, so some people can go the other way too.
No, that's not me.
No, but I am glad that you did get some help. Now, obviously, you got some chemo, and tell me your experience with that.
Right. Well, so my tumor was, I don't know how much to tell you, how much detail to go into.
Yeah,
but
no, I'd love to.
Okay, basically, my tumor was really small, and it was only because I had the cancer had spread to two lymph nodes under my arm, and because of the type of cancer I had, which was, it's called HER2-new, or HER2, which means that your cancer cells express too much of a protein called HER2. And it's a relatively aggressive form of cancer. So because of that, even though the tumor was very small, my surgeon and my oncologist thought that it would be best to have chemotherapy. So I had a lumpectomy. I had 6 rounds of chemotherapy. I had radiation, 37 days of radiation. Mm-hmm. And actually, in my story, I talk about the radiation and, you know, that stiff upper lip that I had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that lip kind of dissolved when I had radiation, which for me, the radiation part of it was terrifying. And I realized during that I actually needed people around me. And then I had a year of this antibody called Herceptin, which is a targeted therapy just for the type of cancer that I had. And I did experience some chemo brain or so-called chemo brain. And it was about halfway through my treatment. And I began to feel just completely in a fog. I wasn't like myself at all. I couldn't think. My memory was just, you know, a sieve. And I remember some very vivid examples coming home. This was right after a treatment that I had. I'd come home and we had people working in the house and I had to pay them. And I got out the checkbook and I really couldn't even think. I didn't even know, you know, the bill was, I don't know what it was. It might've been $75, whatever it was. But I went to write out, let's say it was 75. I went to write it out. And I couldn't think if there were zeros or not. And I actually started to write zeros behind, several zeros behind the 75. And I had to catch myself and say, is that right? And I didn't know what date to put on the check. And the weirdest thing, I've never actually told anybody this, but, and I don't know where this came from, but when I signed the check, I actually signed it with my maiden name, which I hadn't used. You know, I've been married more than, let's say, 20 years, and a long time. And I wrote my maiden name, which I hadn't used for all of those years since I've been married. And then I had some other very strange examples and examples other people I think have as well, where you get disoriented. And I was at the shopping mall in Century City, which is a big mall in Los Angeles. And I had been there over the years. I knew the mall very well, spent a lot of money at that mall. And I couldn't find my way out. Everything was so strange. It was like being in a Twilight Zone episode. Stores that I knew were in a certain place didn't seem to be there anymore. And I didn't know how one store related to the other. I didn't know where the food court was in relation to the stores. And it was getting really late, and I started to get really nervous, and I tried to find my car, and I couldn't find it. It's a subterranean garage, and I had to go down different escalators, and I couldn't find my car anywhere. And finally, the only reason I found it was because I went up and down, up and down, up and down, going through every side of the garage, pushing on my key alarm, on my keychain, until the alarm went off. And it really was very terrifying. And other people will tell you similar stories where they get caught in stores, they can't find their way out. And so that was another example. And then just little examples, which were ridiculous. I speak to my sister every day. We're very close. And I couldn't remember her phone number. And I couldn't remember my brother's phone number, same situation. And, you know, how silly is that, a phone number that you call, you know, 2-3 times a day?
Well, what did you attribute this to? Did you think this has something to do with my treatment? Did you think it was a side effect of being tired? Because I wanted to mention, you know, in the book, you know, you and Dr. Silverman talk about, you know, that when you speak with the doctor, he mentions, you know, the possible side effects of hair loss and fatigue and nausea and maybe mouth sores. But, you know, they don't mention this chemo brain, and a lot of them don't actually believe it. And if you could talk about that, and then Dr. Silverman, I'd like to hear your opinion on that as well.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know what it was because my doctors had never talked about it in any concrete way. And I just thought it was stress. I thought it was psychological. You know, I thought, well, God, am I under so much stress that I've taken on so much, you know, not allowing, not sharing my the pain that I was going through, not sharing the grief over my cancer that I was going through, that this was all just sort of a buildup. I had no idea what it was. And when I went back to look at the information that I have about the drugs that I took, it talked about the hair loss, it talked about nausea, it talked mm-hmm. about other side effects that were horrifying, but nowhere on those documents did it talk about being in some kind of a fog. So I didn't know what it was. And, you know, it wasn't until maybe about 6 or 7 months later that I learned that other people were experiencing the same thing.
Okay. And Dr. Silverman, you obviously saw patients that were complaining about or talking about these issues. What did you think at first?
So, well, it'd be good to mention, first of all, that sure. the ideal circumstances for getting the chemotherapy are exactly why this has become such a widespread problem, that is, these kind of post-chemo syndromes, such a widespread problem in the last decade or so. It's not that it didn't exist before, but the awareness of it was much less, even among patients, and much, much less among the professional community, who were kind of lagging a decade or two behind patients in acknowledging this as a problem related to the chemotherapy. But what happened in the past is that chemotherapy used to be something that you would get primarily when you were kind of at the last stages of disease, pretty advanced stages, and so you wouldn't last a lot longer after that normally. But what started happening a decade or so ago is that chemotherapy started being used in a widespread way at earlier and earlier stages of diseases. So people would get it in the situation like Idel just explained, where she said her tumor was very small, and she was just at the early stages of having just been diagnosed as something that they call adjuvant therapy, meaning right after you get the surgery, you get the chemotherapy instead of, you know, waiting to see if it spreads, or even what they call neoadjuvant therapy, meaning that even before you have your first surgery, they give you chemotherapy just to kind of mop up any cells that might have strayed away. And what that means is that people are getting diagnosed and treated at such an early stage that they have cures for their cancer. They become long-term survivors, and the single biggest impediment that they complain about in the long run to their quality of life overall has been these changes in their cognitive abilities. And no one was surprised at the time that people were having problems around the time that they were getting the cancer diagnosis or around the time that they were getting the chemotherapy with all the stresses that involves and all the kinds of side effects of the chemotherapy. But the big surprise was that long after the chemotherapy is done, a substantial portion of people are having problems with their cognitive abilities, their abilities, as we said, to concentrate or to think or to have to remember things that they're encountering or being able to be oriented in the way that they were. Some people get better and some people get completely better, but there's a substantial portion who don't.
You know, you talk about in the book about Alzheimer's and that you talk about it, that it's an unyielding progressive disease. And you would just mention that with this, the actual symptoms can reverse, improve, reach a plateau, or, you know, they can remain constant. You mentioned that in the book. And the other thing, too, you know, it's just, I'm so glad that you've written this book and that you're on the show and that you're getting the word out, because in the book, there are other people interviewed. And one that especially touched me was this woman who said, my oncologist said there are no data out about chemo brain. Well, obviously, he was wrong. She was wrong. He discounted it, saying, I'm 50, the whole menopause thing. He patted me on the back, made me feel like I'm an idiot. And I'm thinking, you know, Barbara, that was the last thing she needed. You know, you're having enough issues. You don't need some doctor to be condescending. And I find that a lot, not to generalize doctors, but, you know, when they're not familiar with something, they tend to have this, oh, no, everything's fine kind of attitude. And I'm wondering how they're responding, Dr. Silverman, to you and your research. Are they open-minded?
Well, that was, oh, how doctors are responding.
Yeah.
that depends a lot on the doctor.
Yeah, of course.
Even within a field, but it also, there's some field variation. So doctors in the more neurologic or psychiatric oriented fields are not surprised. In fact, they've been hearing patients complain to them for years and years about these problems, and they've noticed in their own observations that a lot of these are happening around the time or after the time that they've had cancer and chemotherapy, and that if they've had the opportunity to see these people as patients before the time they had cancer chemotherapy, then the differences to them are often, you know, very clear, and the association with the timing of cancer and chemotherapy is very clear too. The people who were, as a group, probably most resistant were the oncologists themselves. And you know, as Idella was saying, when you do any procedure, including, you know, chemotherapy that has any major consequence, it's the professional obligation of the oncologist or whoever's administering the procedure to go over all the likely or potential risks and benefits, and even the unlikely ones if they're significant. So, for example, if you get, you know, even a relatively minor procedure these days, they'll run through a big list and they'll say, and side effects can include blah, 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 or death, you know.
Yeah.
And if you think about how big an impact that having decreased cognitive abilities can have on your life, for that not to be even mentioned as a possible side effect, as we've mentioned before, either represents, you know, an ignorance on the part of the person who's going through that list, or kind of an evasion of their professional duty to fully inform the patient about what could potentially happen.
Yeah, because people need to be informed. I mean, that really is a big deal. And, you know, it's funny, we don't have a call-in show, and it's funny, you may have heard the phone ringing in the background. Somebody actually called in anyway to call and ask. They wanted to know about, you know, the difference between, could it for some people just be emotional stress, or, you know, how do you differentiate for some folks?
Yeah, so emotional stress can exacerbate just about any condition, including the post-chemo syndrome. But what we know is that this isn't caused by or simply represent another manifestation of emotional stress. And we know that for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. First of all, we know it because if you do, you know, if you actually measure how impaired people are by, say, a battery of neuropsychological tests like a psychologist would administer, and if you measure how stressed people are, how depressed they are, how anxious they are, there's almost no correlation between the two. There are people who are very impaired and don't even realize they're impaired, according to impairment as measured by these neuropsychological tests, and who feel very little stress. And there are people who actually complain a lot about being impaired. And that actually, how much they complain or how much they perceive themselves to be impaired, that correlates with stress and that correlates with depression. But those things don't correlate with how impaired they are as measured by neuropsychological tests.
Yeah, and I was pretty shocked reading the book of just how impaired some folks are. I mean, if you want to talk about that, Adele. Now, did you do the interviews with the other folks who have cancer and
went through
chemo? Can you tell us about some of those? I mean, I was really touched.
Yeah. Well, even before I started doing interviews for the book, I started observing in the support group that I was at the wellness community, what was happening. And really, you know, aside from talking about your cancer and going through some of the treatments that you've been through and getting support that way, one of the very big topics was talking about the cognitive impairment that people were having. But again, they didn't know about that it was, they didn't really know what it was. They didn't know what label to put on it. And I began to realize that these were very competent people who, prior to chemo, had run households, they were in business, they were doctors, they were engineers, they were attorneys, they were just highly sufficient and competent people. And they began to tell these stories in the group about not being able to focus long enough to read a book any longer. Some of them would say they'd have cereal in the morning and read the box, you know, the back of the box, and they couldn't make it through the description on the back of the cereal box. They'd be embarrassed to be with friends because, you know, outside of the cancer community, because they couldn't follow the thread of a conversation. They would leave things burning on the stove. They'd leave water running in the sink. They would not pay their bills because just the act of opening up an envelope and reading the material inside that envelope was so daunting that they didn't want to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I already had a very good idea of what was going on. So then, after Dan and I got together and started writing this book and I started interviewing people, I began to realize it's much more than just a feeling of competence, that this was actually affecting people's lives. And we have several pretty lengthy stories in the book, one of which is a story about Patrick. And Patrick is a radiation oncologist, and he's one of the few people in the book where we had to change his name and the city that he lived, because he was so deeply embarrassed about what had happened to him that he made me promise that I wouldn't reveal his identity. So what had happened with him was he had been this very highly regarded radiation oncologist and won all kinds of awards. His patients just loved him dearly. But he had had treatment for lymphoma, and he went back to work very soon afterward. And he began making all of these mistakes. And he was mortified because this was somebody who prided himself on his work, and he never made mistakes. In fact, he caught other people's mistakes. But he told me these stories where he would call the patient, do a consultation, hang up, pick up the phone again, dial the same person, and start with the same consultation. He had not remembered that he had called her to make to talk with her. And then he started making other mistakes in terms of reading mammograms. And you can imagine how dangerous that can be if you miss seeing a tumor on a mammogram. So he had to quit. And it basically just destroyed his life at that moment because being a doctor was his life. And the way he described it to me was he lost his edge. He would say things to me like, I'm not the same person that my wife married. He would do things at home, you know, like that example of leaving food burning on the stove. He told me once that he went to the supermarket with his wife. They loaded up the car with groceries, and he drove off and left her behind. And he didn't even realize it until he got home. So you hear stories like this. Yeah. And what's kind of interesting about Patrick is he seems to be doing a lot better. I just talked with him recently, and he is doing better.
Oh, good.
But that's one story, and there are many, many stories like that in the book.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I like about the book, too, is that you not only talk about the chemo brain, but you talk about relationships, fatigue, depression, hormones, sleep, fear, stress, mindfulness, and a lot more. You talk about brain food, and I wish we had time to get into all of these things, and I really want to encourage people to, you know, get the book, but I'm wondering if perhaps a 9-step program to keep your brain sharp is helping Patrick and Dr. Silverman, if you can tell us about those 9 steps.
Okay, well, maybe
Adele.
Comment about whether it's happening Patrick specifically.
Yes, sure.
I haven't personally talked with him since the time of the book.
Well, what's happening with Patrick is that he's doing more cognitively. He's really trying to exercise his brain in a big way. He used to be an avid New York Times crossword puzzle worker, and after chemo, he couldn't do one crossword puzzle, and that was so upsetting to him.
That is upsetting.
And so now, he said, before he couldn't even get, you know how the crossword puzzle gets harder and harder every day for the New York Times. You know, start with Monday, and then Sunday is kind of the spare of a puzzle. Well, he couldn't do Mondays at all, but now he's at Wednesdays, and he's doing better. And he's been taking a foreign language course, the kind that you can comes on CDs, so you can do at home. So he's doing that. And he's actually starting to write his own book on a topic that's very important to him. And even though everything takes him a little bit longer and he's slower, he's making progress.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Right.
That's great. Actually, I wanted to bring up step one real quick. The focus every day on only those things you can influence or control. That's good advice for everybody. I was reading that and thinking, oh, my gosh, I need to take that to heart. So I think that's wonderful. But if we only have a few minutes left, if you can just tell us maybe some of your favorite steps or ones that you want to mention on the radio.
Well, to begin with the one you just brought up,
sure.
Yeah, that does have meaning beyond this particular context and just a much wider significance. You people are well advised to look at the things that are within their sphere of influence more than the things that aren't, for a lot of reasons, but including some very kind of specific biochemical reasons. That is, there's two kinds of stress to broadly categorize them. There's what they call a kind of learned helplessness type of stress, and that is the kind of stress where you feel that there are a lot of things happening to you that you can't do much about, and that you even learn from trying that you can't make much impact on those. And then those are the ones that cause activation of a sort of stress hormone system in your body that can be very debilitating, including debilitating your immune system, so it can make you sicker, which is another stress. And then there's the stresses that represent kind of little challenges that you are able to rise to, and that you feel yourself, even if you can't solve them all in a day, that if you work on them, then you're making progress on them. And those kind activate a different system of hormones in your body, the kind that revs you up, the things that release adrenaline, for example, and get the parts of your brain and other parts of your body that you need to actually be able to face those problems in higher working order.
Okay.
And so they have a much more positive effect, and they don't have that same kind of debilitating effect that the first set of stresses do. And by focusing on the second kind instead of the first kind, you're automatically kind of bringing the biochemistry of your body into being your ally in facing problems in general. and making it less likely that you'll slip down a path of going into deeper feelings of stress or depression or anxiety for both real reasons and for reasons that are more inside your body than outside your body.
I got to have you back. I'd like to do a whole show about that because I think too many people are doing the wrong kind of stress,
Right.
So now step two, you talk about setting your biological clock, which is important.
Right. So people often worry about how much sleep they're getting, and you don't really need nearly as much sleep as people often think they do, as they're often told in the media that they do, or even told by doctors that they do, as real sleep. You need some time to be just lying still so that your body can recover, so your muscles and your nervous system that runs your muscles can kind of retune. And that should be for most people somewhere at least 6 hours a day. But even if only 3 of those hours are spent sleeping, in actual, falling asleep, having a good cycle of going into a deep sleep and then getting to some dreams, that's enough to do a lot of the retuning that your brain needs. And if you have about 4 to 5 hours, you've gone through 2 complete cycles, which is about all your brain really needs to do, what your brain needs to do in terms of restoring its energy and restoring its biochemistry to be able to face the next day. And this has been studied in lots of different contexts, like, the military's been very interested in how much they can deprive their sailors of sleep and still have them being able to monitor things accurately on a radar screen and so forth. And we know if they get those two cycles that they'll be okay. And we also know that if they get stimulant drugs, not only does it help them, like any, even caffeine, but more powerful ones that are available by prescription or on the street, depending on your source, that they not only will help them stay awake, but they also will impact on a lot of other things positively, like the ability to maintain concentration and focus and reduce mistakes and increase sense of well-being and so forth. And so the kind of coupling what you can do in terms of your body's own biochemistry with what you can do if you need to have additional help with the biochemistry of prescription or non-prescription drugs can be a very powerful combination.
Oh, good. Well, I wish we had more time. I just want to say some of the other steps real quick. Eat plenty of fruits and vegetables. Make sure to, drink daily from, talks about basic beverage, red wine, and this is interesting. It actually says coffee. Well, you definitely have to come back because we have a lot more to talk about. But I want to thank you both for coming on. I want to tell everyone to go out and get your Brain After Chemo, a practical guide to lifting the fog and getting back your focus. It's such an important topic, and I know this means a lot to so many people.
And we have a website.
Oh, yes, thank you. I was about to ask. Yes, how do we get in contact with you?
They can go to our website, which is yourbrainafterchemo.com, and we both, I'm speaking for Dan, but I'm sure it's true, we'd both be happy to respond to any questions that we get.
Oh, that's great. And I'd love to have you come back on in a few months if you can. And if you'd like to reach me, you can go to itsyourhealthradio.org. Joining us Thursday at 9:30 are some amazing women to talk about the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women program. So be sure to tune in. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Keep being healthy. Bye-bye.